Ahem. We all about simmered down? Okay. Let me go kill the music here. All right, this time for real, we're back. The first time I heard Frank X. Walker reading poems from Buffalo Dance back in Louisville, it occurred to me that this book, with its scope and slant and story arc, was such an ingenious, inevitable idea that even if he had no talent as a poet, it was bound to be good. Frank clearly did his homework, his research fueled by a curiosity for history, an appetite for story, and a passion for activism. And this collection tells the story of Lewis and Clark's famous expedition from the point of view of Clark's slave, his boy, York. But let's not forget, we're here tonight for a poetry reading, and Frank is a talented poet. Listen to this from a poem called God's House. Now I ain't what you would call a scripture quoter, but the first time I seen the waterfall at Missouri, felt a herd of buffalo stampede, and looked down from top of Rock Mountains, it was like church. And where else but God's house can a body servant big as me carry a rifle, hatchet, and a bone-handled knife so sharp it can peel the black off a lump of coal, and the white man still close his eyes and feel safe at night? Frank X. Walker's images are irresistible, surprising, imaginative, and completely believable coming from an uneducated man born into slavery and deeded to Massa Clark down on a plantation in Virginia. Not only are the images striking and playful, they are deeply moving as Frank explores the heart and mind of York, his sadness and being separated from his wife, his longing for freedom, and his profound insights into white American civilization. Here's another gem. I suspect the deepest hurt in the world be to risk being tied to a woman's hearth, then standing on the front porch while the massa part her thighs, knowing that any cry raised is inviting death or worse. But what else but love make you hold that woman tighter, try to rock her back to hold long after the tears dry up and the hurt turns the ashes back to flames? Frank's book is filled with these rich, powerful images, making it one of the more moving and enjoyable books of poetry. What? Enjoyable poetry books? How radical. I've heard in a long while, and rather than take any more time reading excerpts, let me let Frank speak for himself, and also speak, of course, for York. Please welcome Executive Director of the Governor's School of the Arts and founding member of the Afro-Latian Poets, my friend and fellow former student at Spalding University, Frank X. Walker.
You're way too kind. You haven't heard me read yet. You guys doing all right? I'm going to ask a couple of favors. I'm going to ask you to pretend like you didn't hear those two poems you already read or excerpts when they land again in this room. And I'm also going to ask you to not respond in between the poems. Just kind of sit back. Because these poems really work as a unit. They're designed, there are 57 of them. And I'm probably going to read only about a dozen or more, depending on how much you are cringing when I get to certain parts of it. If you can handle it, I'll read a few more. And hopefully there'll be time to read some other kinds, because this is York's voice. This is my first time in St. Louis reading. I'd like for you guys to hear what I sound like, too. But I'm going to start out with this first one. And in some of these cases, I want to give you kind of an introduction, and I hope it's not too condescending, you know, considering that most people recognize that St. Louis is the not just the gateway to the West, but this is the home of everything Lewis and Clark. And it would come as no surprise that part of my research meant spending several weekends at the the museum beneath the arch, which kind of surprised me that it was there. And buying all these books, you know, trying to find every single detail that dealt with York. And unfortunately, there's so little known about him. There are over 100 books, you know, and I'm probably being conservative, about the expedition. And we've heard from Lewis, we've heard from Clark, we've heard from Patrick Gass, we've heard from other people of first-person accounts, and even several books. You know, I found four that just dealt specifically with Sacagawea, and York still hasn't, you know, has not really gotten his due. You know, he hasn't gotten his gold dollar yet. So one of the things that I want to say in the way of introduction that I won't assume that any of you know this because I had an opportunity to work at two different African-American cultural centers and teach African-American history, and this was never part of what I was teaching because I didn't even know about York until I engaged in about 5 months of research. But there are three things that are important about York's story. The first is that he was a big man, that he was bigger than everybody else in the expedition. And if we had to have a contemporary symbol of that, you know, imagine a Julius Peppers or an NFL defensive end. You know, that's a big man. Put a pin in that. The second thing is that York was black, and by all accounts, very black, possibly, you know, first generation African-American. Probably both his parents came over as part of the Middle Passage. But a lot of Native Americans had not seen York, and they gave him nicknames like Raven for his color and Big Medicine because they were so amazed at his strength and his supposed supernatural potential because they had not seen that. And that was maximized when you consider that some of the tribes, when their warriors went out and engaged in battle, when they returned, they would paint the most courageous, most successful warrior black with ashes so that whoever came back into the village painted the blackest, you know, was the biggest hero. So imagine when York showed up, you know, what they must have felt like other than wow. The third thing was York was married. His wife was owned by another family in Louisville, Kentucky. I currently live in Louisville, Kentucky, and part of my motivation was the Louisville and the Kentucky connection. Lewis and Clark came together at the Falls of the Ohio, at Louisville, and began the expedition, although every map in the universe suggested it started right here in St. Louis. So, this first poem opens up with York having been out there for a year and a half and then reflecting on his experience, you know, having experienced, you know, imagine thousands of buffalo, the Rocky Mountains, over 50 tribes of Native Americans, and the ocean for the first time. And, you know, there are fish bigger than any catfish he's ever seen, not just cabin size, but jumping out of the water. And splashing and playing. And he's not just overwhelmed, he wants to tell somebody. He's had to sit for a year and a half while everybody else made notes and wrote details about this expedition, and he couldn't write. So he's bottled up and has all these things to say, but, you know, what does he do? This is how this collection opens, and I won't talk as much as we go through, but I wanted to set the stage for you since I'm not reading all 57 poems. Wind Talker. If I could make my words dress their naked selves in blackberry juice, lay down on a piece of bark, sheep, or onion skin like Massa do, if I could send a letter home to my wife, floated in the wind on wings or water, I'd tell her about Katanka and all the wide and high places this side of the big river. How his family, numbering three for every star in the sky, look like a force when they graze together, turn into the muddy Missouri when they thunder along faster than any horse, making the grass lay down long after the quiet has returned. How they don't so much as raise a tail when I come round with my woolly head and tobacco skin, like I'm one of them, making the Arikara and Mandan think me big medicine, Katanka, who walk like man. today, we stood on the edge of all this, looked out at so much water, the mountains we crossed to get here seem a little smaller. As I watch fish the size of cabins dance in the air and splash back in the water like children playing, I think about her and if we gon' ever be free. Then I close my eyes and pray that I don't live long enough to see Massa make this ugly too. God's house. When we first left Kentucky, the trees had commenced to dressing up the fall harvest, and the garden was already full of pumpkins and squash. Massa Clark didn't ask me to go on no expedition. He just say, pack, and pointed to the dough. So I gather up what little I got, and more than I can carry his, and head off to a sail-bearing keelboat where his friend, Massa Lewis, is waiting. That boat was so big you could lay any 10 of the 16 men on board or 8 of me head to toe and still have enough room for the dog. We start out on the Ohio and swing up the Old Man of Rivers. When we gets to the mouth of the Dark Woman they calls the Big Muddy, we sets up winter camp a good canoe ride from St. Louis. That spring, when the rains come, we cross the Mississippi and commence to climb in the Missouri and float right up through heaven on earth. More sky than I ever seen, rocks as pretty as trees, and game so plentiful, they come right down to the riverbank and invite themselves to dinner. Now, I ain't what you would call a scripture quoter, but the first time I seen the waterfall in Missouri, felt a herd of buffalo stampede, and looked down from the top of Rock Mountains, it was like church. And where else but God's house can a body servant big as me carry a rifle, hatchet, and a bone-handled knife so sharp it can peel the black off a lump of coal? And the white man still close his eyes and feel safe at night. Now, one of the things that I realized I had to do was explain, you know, York's affinity with words. And I invented York's father's role in this whole scenario. His father was also owned by William Clark, as were several members of his family. But every family has a storyteller. And I made the poetic leap and said that York's father was the family storyteller, which explained his affinity for storytelling and helped set up this poem called Primer. The only book we allowed to know is the Bible. Though many a slave been sold south, had fingers chopped off, and worse, for the crime of reading and writing. I figures my respect for a good telling come from listening to old York weave his magic at night. Folk hung from our porch like baby possums and lived off the truth he give to every story, no matter how many times they tasted the tale. I learned to appreciate the power of single words holding a lamp over Massa Clark while he studied his brother's letters and struggled with his own returns. Them think all slaves dumb because we can't cipher, but they be surprised how many words we pick up just standing around like trees in a room full of educated men. One of the important stories in this book is York's relationship with his wife, and she's introduced in a poem called Sundays and Christmas. And a lot of my research was done using slave narratives, specifically from Virginia and Kentucky in the same time period. But it was clear from the research that, however unrecognized the relationship was, the married slaves, if they saw each other and were owned by different families, it was rare. It might happen on Sundays and Christmas, hence Sundays and Christmas. I cares plenty for my wife, but I've been told a slave can't truly know love, being as massa and white men's in general have and takes certain privileges with our women. I suspect the deepest hurt in the world be to risk being tied to a woman's hearth, then standing on the front porch while the massa part her thighs, knowing that any cry raised is inviting death or worse. But what else but love make you hold that woman even tighter? Try to rock her back to whole long after the tears dry up and the hurt turns the ashes back to flames. It being nighttime and deep into winter, I can think of no other breath I wish to feel and no other whisper I ache to hear. What we loud to feel might not rate as love, but it be powerful enough to make you rule the time between visits. One of the things that was really clear from the research is that the Native Americans responded to York's features very differently than his enslavers. The very same features that he was denigrated for, his African features, big nose, dark skin, in a lot of the tribes he was worshipped for that. So I imagine that there's no way he could respond to that in any other way but to also respect them back. So I have them, you know, I have that relationship being a strong, mutual, respectful relationship. And I want to read two or three poems from the middle section. There's about 20 poems that introduce Sacagawea into the story, and she arrives in North Dakota, and several encounters with Native Americans, and that's all in the middle section of the book. But I'm just going to read about three of those. Wasikum Sapa. Several miles up the river, Captain Clark, named after a tribe of the Sioux, a Hidatsa chief sent for us. His eagle feather and pride made him most as tall as me. He spit on his fingers and rubbed my skin hard, thinking it paint that wears off. Meaning to help him understand, I took off my hat and let him touch my woolly head. Satisfied that I was not a black white man, he looked deep into my eyes and stared at his own reflection. After parading the uniformed men and guns and other signs of power, the captains sat with each chief, made great noise about peace and friendship, before heaping upon them gifts of knives, tobacco, spirits, needles, cloth, and beads of every size and color, which pleased the women very much. Calling them children, the captains would point to everything under the sky, say it now belonged to their great white father, and show off his image on the face side of a big coin they unwrapped and presented with much putting on. Sometimes the chiefs would laugh and say the great spirit who owned all this could not ride on the back of such a small thing. Sometimes them say nothing. Promises. Many tribes speak their peace by talking with their hands and faces. When we sit in the circle to talk with Sacagawea's brother, the chief, she take his words in Shoshone and measure them out in Hidatsa. Charbonneau hands it to Labiche in French. Labiche gives it to the captains in English. Then they talks between themselves and so forth and so on and sends it back down the line. The words seem to be on their own expedition, but it's hard to believe the truth can be traded on that many tongues and still taste like itself. I'm going to skip quite a bit here, and one of the things that I wanted to respect was the position Lewis and Clark have in our history. You know, they're clearly American heroes, but if you don't read the history close enough, you think it was only Lewis and Clark, and Sacagawea showed up like for a week or something, but you know, you guys are experts, so you know that's not true. But I want to introduce two poems that talk about, that has York talking about Lewis and Clark. Double yokes. There wasn't what you call opposites in the way that salt is to pepper or night is to day, but they was a natural team, yoked together the way hands and feet work out their differences in order to pick up a thing and carry it to some other place. To have one of them drown or to pass on like Sergeant Floyd did a spell back would have been like paddling a canoe only on one side. Captain Clark had some book learning, but Master Lewis held on to the things he read the way a boy swooned forever about his first kiss. He pulled sayings out the air like he plucking fruit, then smiled because he liked the way it tastes. He had a bucket full of $2 words he used when scratching in his books. He scribbled for hours about one little flower or strange new animals like the deer goat And them little toy dogs we come across that lived in holes in the ground. Captain Clark at home on or off the river might scratch in his book for a minute, but he seemed to prefer the company round the fire where he laughed and talked and defended his friend's long walks and time alone with his dog and books. Two roosters could never be friends in a barnyard, but these two took turns crowing and giving orders and were so often of the same mind you would think they was hatched from the same egg. What seemed to bind them together was not just orders from Washington, but the cocksure notion that they would finish what they started or die trying together. One of the other themes is York's attention to the fact that everybody was writing things down and drawing. If you've seen the journals, and I'm sure many of you have, Lewis was a pretty good artist, and he made some very detailed sketches. At the same time, Clark had very detailed maps of the region. This is a poem called Ornithologist. We pick up a few things watching the Indians track and hunt. They know the calls and movements of birds and animals, so much so they can mock anything in the woods, even deer, and them don't hardly speak. The captains have us all looking and listening for birds and beasts, and was happy as larks if we could bring something new with wings back to camp, mostly whole or breathing. Captain Lewis would peer in his eyeglass stick for hours, trying to know a bird that caught his eye, and could scratch out on paper exactly how the thing be, shape of the head and beak, markings on the feathers, toes, feet, and all. It was like the woodpecker or crow and such just walk up, make itself small, and lay right down on the page. Now I'm going to skip a whole lot and go to the very end of the collection so that you get a sense of what the arc of this story is. The title of the book is called Buffalo Dance, The Journey of York. And the journey is not simply what happened in those 3 years. We say 3 years because in Kentucky they left in 03, October 26, 1803. But how much he changed in that time, you know, I'm assuming, and based on the research, you know, it's not a huge assumption that being treated differently and having a chance to be in the midst of all that wonderful nature and natural things allowed him to have a greater appreciation for the outdoors and also start to grow spiritually. And but at the same time, in this arc, things changed once they got to the ocean and started the return back. And this poem called Unravel introduces the downward part of that arc. And a lot of people don't know that even though Clark was very successful in government after they returned from the expedition, Clark committed suicide several years later. And there are accounts in a journal that suggest that he may have been manic depressive. And there are descriptions of that in William Clark's journals. And I think Patrick Gass also Unravel. I reckon the only sour part about pouring your whole self into a thing like finding the ocean, be finding it. On the trip back home, we seemed to run all out of laughter and goodwill. We all sunk pretty low, but our hearts touched the ground when we left Sacagawea back with the Mandan and Hadatsa. Her company had been a spark of light for me when the sun had gone down on everything else. Her little brave made such a mark on Master Clark that he offered to keep him to raise. There were days when Captain Lewis hardly opened his mouth, even to Master Clark. This seemed odd for a man who loved words so much. Tempers were short. Campfires was quiet. The good in some of these men would lay down with them at night and be gone by sunup. It seemed like the search for the treasure was the real treasure. After kissing the ocean, the expedition just become a long trip home. When they arrived back in St. Louis, it was clear from the journals that York was jailed frequently and put in the stockades for drunkenness and unruliness. But part of that of, you know, I wanted to try to make sense of his change in attitude. And this poem called Revisionist History begins to explain that. When we set foot back in old St. Louis, there was much celebration and putting on, as everyone had given us up for dead. We paraded through the streets, firing our guns, and made a home in the nearest tavern. No one seemed to tire of hearing us tell our stories night after night. After too many cups and tellers, there came tales of herds of grizzlies, big talking fish, and Indian women 10 foot tall. The truth seemed to stretch so that by and by, I seemed to disappear from their tongues, as if I had never even been there, as if my blackness never even saved their hides. Them twist the tails and leave out my parts in it, so much so that directly I become Master Clark's boy again, just along to cook and carry. Most of these poems are introduced by an epigraph that is taken directly from the Lewis and Clark journals or some other historic document. I'm going to read two excerpts from that are taken from letters from William Clark to his brother Jonathan, and they are about York. Permit him to stay a few weeks with his wife. He wishes to stay there altogether and hire himself, which I have refused. He prefers being so to returning here. If any attempt is made by York to run off or to refuse to perform his duty as a slave, I wish him sent to New Orleans and sold, or hired out to some severe master until he thinks better of such conduct. He has got such a notion about freedom and his immense services that I do not expect he will be of much service to me again. I gave him a severe trouncing the other day, and he has much mended since. This is York. Master Clark's and his brother, several boxes filled with pelts, horns, moccasins, and other Indian goods received in trade back home on the keelboat from the Mandans. I sent my wife a buffalo robe to put her in mind of me when winter come again. I've been carrying some gifts, a Indian corn, a seashell from the ocean, a grizzly bear tooth, and some rocks rubbed smooth by the Missouri in the medicine bag I keeps round my neck. Though it been 3 long winters since I seen her smile, Massa be so sad in his old ways, I fear that next time I sets my eyes on her might be my last. Just rewards. I rode and walked as much and carried more than any man on the expedition. When we returned, Master Clark got acres of land, lots of pay, and a grand ball in his honor. I got a short week in Kentucky to say a goodbye to my wife before returning to his new home in St. Louis. Unable to fill all my emptiness with whiskey, I earned many lashes at his hands for being what he calls insolent and sulky, or what I calls speaking up for my freedom. Holy water. I don't know what get in Master's head and have him think a generous whip make me a better slave. Don't know who told that lie about whiskey making ugly pretty, or drinking taking pain away. But what else put a song in your mouth when there be nothing left to sing about? What else let you laugh at the handful of salt rubbed deep into your own bloody flesh, make you forget how much you hates being alive, make you believe you can drown all your loss, all your fears, and wash away any thoughts of revenge? It seemed like the life of a slave is only the first parts of Easter. So I sprinkle myself, bury my back, and swallow. One of the things in this part of the book, there's a lot of tension, and obviously anger and disappointment. But I wanted to put what I consider a love poem in the middle of all this. I wanted to describe York's first night back with his wife after 3 years, and him thinking that, you know, he has 1,000 things to share with her, and this might be his last night or week. So every single minute is very precious. And You jazz fans may appreciate this title. It's called A Love Supreme. On that first night back, me and her move like turtles, unwrapping the old, the news, and each other. We outlast a candle and the moon, laughing and talking and crying, then pretends we are earth and sky, hunger and fruit, a black mountain and an all-skin quilt of snow, salty and sticky and wet. We knows all we have is this here, so we unshackle us clothes, become one with the night, and be free. This section also contains, I think, possibly the angriest poem. You know, York, in my estimation, could not have experienced all of this and missed his wife so much and want to be back there and not be angry about it. And there's a connection to his being jailed and drinking and his behavior. And all through the book, York is constantly symbolized as a buffalo. He fancies himself as a buffalo. But one of the, I guess, the most dangerous things they experienced, as detailed by, you know, many parts of everybody's journals, they talk about, you know, how, what a terrible creature the grizzly bear was. So this is a poem called Ursa Major. When I be my best self, I be all buffalo, quiet as a mountain, proud, strong, without fear, able to see the good in everything. But like most God's creatures, when I can't find my own light, or when the world try to blow it out, there be a darker York, a York that mirrors more the grizzly than the woolly-headed thunder bringer. Knowing how much Massa Clark feared the great bear after sending his bullets only seemed to make him mad, when I sinks deep into my worst self with a little help from whiskey's bite, I try to bring as much fear and destruction as anything we run up on in the wild. This grizzly knows no fear and is not afraid to die. He is only afraid that when he wakes up, he'll just be a slave again. I'm going to end with this one more poem. It's not the last poem in the collection, but it is the poem I think kind of completes the arc and suggests that the York that was kind of a humble servant and accepted his role at the very beginning actually makes a transition, becomes somebody who actually understands what freedom might be and he wants it. This is called Cumulonimbus. What I come to know is no man born a slave, serving another for life, agreeing to be treated like cows and pigs and less, be something a slave way every day after he look at his other choices, death and running. Slaving ain't no picnic. We might look happy, but us grin mostly to keeps from crying. Oh, York say it takes something African to stand in the rain and smile while it's storming all around. He say nobody choose the slave. Them choose to hold on to what little family them got. Them choose to be sure somebody's still here to tell our side, to tell the whole truth when it all said and done. What some calls lightning and thunder, just be God trying to see what we choosing and us grumbling about being slaves. Thank you. You're embarrassing me. I'm going to read a couple other poems, which are totally different from York's voice, but I feel like this might be a rare or last opportunity. And I'll try to read maybe one or two from Appalachia. This is a kind of an older collection now, but these are poems that deal with family and place, identity, and social justice issues. And since it's almost March, and madness is about to ensue all over the country, I want to read a poem called Death by Basketball. And you wouldn't know anything about that around here, right? Before and after school, he stood on a milk crate, eyeballed the mirror, and only saw Wayne Turner at tournament time. A third grader, just off the bus, barely 4 feet off the ground, he dropped his books, sank a J from the top of the key, and heard the crowd roar. Beat his man off the dribble with a break-your-neck crossover, and slammed himself on the cover of a box of Wheaties. He was out there every night, under a street light, fighting through double picks, talking trash to imaginary body checks. You can't hold me, fool, fake right. This is my planet, drive left. Is the camera on? Reverse layup. Finish the tray from downtown. Swish! I'm in the zone tonight. Who got next? More than a little light in the ass. Hands so small the ball almost dribbled him. He formed his own layup line in the bluegrass. Wildcat jersey hanging like a summer dress on a court-made ball from daily use. And instead of writing his spelling words, he signed a contract he could barely read. Inked a commitment in big block letters to the NBA and Nike and Sprite. Scribbled superstar in cursive with a fat red pencil and practiced his million-dollar smile, not his multiplication table. Thinking of how many chocolate milks he could buy with his sign-in bonus or his all-star game appearance fee after recess. Another shooting, another tragic death, another little genius who would never test out of a dream that kills legitimate futures every night under streetlights wherever these products are sold. All right, thank you. I read one of the family poems. This is a poem that I wrote initially for my mother and her sisters, but by the time I got finished with the editing process, it turned into kind of a tribute to a whole generation of domestic workers, particularly those workers and mothers who would do anything so that children could have a better opportunity. And this is called Statues of Liberty. Mama scrubbed rich white porcelain and hardwood floors on her hands and knees, hid her pretty face and body in sack dresses and Aunt Jemima scarves from predators who assumed for a few extra dollars before Christmas in dark kitchen pantries they could unwrap her present. Aunt Helen, her sister, took in Miss Emerine's laundry every Saturday morning, sent it back hand-washed, air-dried, starched, ironed, folded, and cleaner than any professional service. She waited patiently for her good white woman to die and make good on her promise to leave her a little something, only to leave her first. Aunt Bertha, the eldest, exported her maternal skills to suburbia to provide surrogate attention to children of money and privilege, and spent every other moment preaching about the richness of the afterlife before the undertaker took her to see for herself. Housekeepers, washerwomen, maids, a whole generation of portable daycare centers traded their days for dimes, allowing other women the freedom to shop and sunbathe, the opportunity to school or work. This curse-swallowing sorority dodged dicks and bosses before post-war women punched clocks. They birthed civil and human rights, gave the women movement legs, sacrificed their then to pave the way for a now. Their hard-earned pennies sent us off to college and into the world. Our success is their reward. We are their monuments, but they are our statues of liberty. Thank you.